Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, episode 78, She Said Dongle. Hi, I'm Denise Howell, and you're tuned in for This Week in Law. I'm here this week with a great panel of folks and a great bunch of stories for you, so let's get right to it. We've got Lauren Gelman. Lauren, first time on the show, but long time on my wish list. Great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Wonderful to see you here.
Great to be here.
Yeah, we've got lots of stuff to go through with you. I want to find out what you're up to these days, too. I've sort of lost touch with you for a while, so I want to catch up. Also joining us is someone I have not ever had the chance to catch up with, so I'm very glad to meet for the first time and introduce to you Jonathan Frieden. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, Denise. How are you?
I'm great. How are you doing?
Great.
Good. So Jonathan writes the e-commerce law blog and is a lawyer, as you can see if you are watching the video. He's clearly in his office with the classic lawyer background behind him. A lawyer on e-commerce and technology issues, which is a great fit, obviously, for our show. So thanks so much for joining us today, Jonathan.
Thanks for having me, Denise.
And also with us again is Evan Brown from internetcases.com and Hinshaw & Carson in Chicago, Illinois, home of the half-year celebration of the way to St. Patrick's Day. Hi, Evan.
Right. That's the big news today, halfway to St. Patrick's Day. And, you know, for some reason I forgot it, but, you know, things are happy here in Chicago today. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm wearing green, so, you know, I didn't know, but here we go. We're matching the theme.
It all works out somehow. Good job.
It does. Well, some people that are not green, they're maybe green because their stomachs are turning. And I'll keep with our tradition of leading with our most lascivious show or story in the show notes. And that one has to do with some engineers at Google who were mucking about with people's email and chats. And the good news is they've been fired. The bad news is just having an awareness that this kind of thing can and apparently did happen. Lauren, you want to bring us up to speed about exactly what went on here and why it was so bad?
Sure. So the most recent revelation here is Gawker. Had an article on Wednesday, which revealed that a Google engineer located in Washington State had been allegedly unlawfully and also certainly against Google's policies looking into minors' email addresses and email accounts and other private information that was attached to their accounts, their voice chats, and their use of other Google information that we all assume is private, both from snooping eyes outside of Google and also from the Google employees themselves. Once that was revealed, Google was also disclosed that this had previously happened with another person who was an employee of Google. Both of these people have been fired. Neither of them were reported to law enforcement authorities, which is somewhat controversial because there is an allegation of unlawful conduct here, as well as simply just having Google deal with this as a employee issue. And really, this brings to the public one of the most interesting questions in privacy, which is a lot of times we focus on what a company's purposeful sharing of information is with third parties, or what happens when law enforcement comes and asks for information. But there is another very important risk, which is the employees of the company themselves and what kind of security and audit paths are in place to make sure that it's not users of the company, whether it be Google or any of the other Silicon Valley companies that have a lot of our information, who are using this information, and whether they're using it just for their own laughs or to stalk people or for financial gain. So this was a really interesting story to sort of bring to the forefront an issue that a lot of people have been thinking about for a while, which is how are companies themselves protecting the information once it's held within the company from other employees being able to see it.
So I guess this is a real eye-opener for folks that you don't really think about someone at your online service provider mucking about in your data. And certainly you would think that there would be a very stringent screening process to try and ensure that you have employees both that are hired that would be above such activity, and also, you know, a reinforcement of those concepts once people are employed. And, Google notoriously has one of the most stringent hiring processes around, but apparently in these couple of cases, no system is perfect. Evan, what do you think about this?
Well, the thing that's interesting to me is figuring out where, if anywhere, there actually was illegal conduct that went on here. And I know, Lauren, you mentioned that, it was kind of puzzling, or maybe some people would be puzzled why Google didn't go to the authorities with this if there was some kind of unlawful activity. And my thoughts along these lines are, if there was anything that was unlawful, it seems like it would be a violation of the Stored Communications Act, based on what I heard here. I know that the engineer is alleged to have gone in, or is reported to have gone in and looked at some communications, some Google chat, GChat communications. I think there were also maybe some logs. And the Stored Communications Act, of course, prohibits unauthorized access to that. To those types of stored communications, those electronic communications. But there's an exception to that in Section 2701 that says that the person, or that the provider of that communication service is not, doesn't violate this act by accessing that information. So it seems a bit almost circular, or a bit tautological or something, in this situation, because if the authorization to access these communications was somehow withdrawn, that would have been withdrawn by Google, saying that its employee could not go ahead and access this information. So that puts, in a sense, the entire discretion, if I'm analyzing this correctly, and I'm just, essentially thinking out loud on this, it would seem to put the entire discretion as to whether or not this was unlawful on Google. And apparently, very clearly, this person was not authorized to do that because it was a violation of the internal policies. So it becomes problematic for Google. They're really maybe in a lose-lose situation. I don't know. It just seems very much hinged on their discretion as to what to do here, as to whether it's unlawful, and then what do they do in taking that next step to actually report this to law enforcement. So bringing this all back to, what kind of the fundamental point I'm trying to make here is that it's really, I think, a tricky situation to determine if there really was unlawful conduct that went here, separate and apart or in addition to violation of Google's internal policies and procedures.
Yeah. So I guess what I would respond is that the question would be whether he had, the employee had exceeded lawful access. And so there's certainly, he is part of a team at Google that is engaged in customer service. So he does have, this is why he had the ability to access that information in the first place. He wasn't hacking into Google's accounts that he wasn't allowed to be in. The issue is the purpose for which he was using this access was not the purpose for which Google had afforded him the access. And it was also wasn't to protect Google's infrastructure. And there are, as you said, there's exceptions in the law where companies are able to access people's accounts under certain circumstances if it's to protect their own systems. So I think they're, you know, depending on exactly what the circumstances are, there could be good arguments for why this would be a law enforcement matter. I think the fact that there were minors involved, and as you said, it was reported that the minors' parents did not want this to go to law enforcement, made this decision a little bit easier for Google. The question is whether it's, you know, having like a third party investigation of this would have been better for the public in seeing exactly what happened here, why this person had the access, how they used it. We're not going to get that kind of data by relying on Google's internal investigation and having just fired them.
Right.
Well, it seems like a lot is known about this. I don't know how Kim Zetter over at Threat Level got her information or the other people who have reported on this case. There's quite a level of detail here in the Threat Level story anyway about how of what was going on here. That there was a 15-year-old boy who met this engineer through a technology group. So they actually knew each other in the real world. And then there was some sort, I mean, that really when you get into the details, it was kind of like high school bullying going on by this engineer wanting to know more about the kid's social life, you know, who his new girlfriend was, and threatening to give information to people that he knew. And I mean, it's just sort of very strange fact pattern here. There are a couple of different liability considerations. Obviously, you know, we're talking about one of them, the notion that these two engineers shouldn't have been doing what they were doing. But of course, there's Google's level of liability too. And I'm wondering, Jonathan, do you think that this is lawsuit material? Are we going to see people coming after Google to crack down on their data protection measures?
Denise, I feel like I should let you know, just in the interest of full disclaimer, full disclosure, I represent Google, so I'm not sure that I could comment on that issue, and I would certainly hope that no one would file suit against Google about it. But if we take this in the context of a broader context so that I can actually speak to it, what you have here is a company that has access to a lot of our private information, as many companies do, that has a limited group of engineers that has a high level of access to that information. And for all the screening in the world, you're going to have people that slip through the cracks. And so what we see in this particular instance is a company that stepped in when a problem resulted from that and terminated the employee. And clearly the employee was accessing the information outside the scope of his employment because he was doing it for a non-work purpose. So should liability result from a large company having our information and slips like this result? Well, it's a case-by-case sort of consideration. I'm not sure that we know enough about this case in particular to determine. And it really is determined by the protections that are in place, how closely they adhere to those protections, and whether those protections can be reasonably viewed as sufficient to protect the type of information involved. Obviously, there's certain information is more sensitive than others than other information. So to the extent that you have access to highly sensitive information, I think the protections in the screening process has to be more strict. To the extent that you have access to information that is publicly available elsewhere, perhaps there's no screening required. But I think it really comes down to a case-by-case determination and analysis of whether the structures in place met the standard of care in the industry for the protection of that information.
You know, it really seems like it would be unfair to go after Google in this type of situation. And here's why I say that. I mean, the most plausible theory would be something like negligent supervision or something like that, some kind of tort theory under state law, which would be tied to, I guess, because Google didn't meet the appropriate standard of care, it allowed this violation of the Stored Communications Act to occur. And here it gets a little bit perhaps more theoretical, but I'm bringing in some analogous thinking over from the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, which has language very similar to the Stored Communications Act and talking about authorization to data being exceeded or something like that. I know here in the Seventh Circuit, we've got a case called Citrin that everybody here in the Seventh Circuit cites whenever we're briefing something on the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. And Judge Posner said that access to information, the authorization is exceeded at that point in which the employee breaches his or her duty of loyalty to his or her employer. So if we're going to try to hold Google liable for some kind of negligent supervision over this employee, that seems really getting at them doubly if we're also going to have established in the same litigation that somebody violated a duty toward them. They would be doubly victimized in that, and in that kind of scenario, under that kind of analysis. And that seems really problematic, and why I would certainly be rooting for Google in any situation with those facts and those allegations and forces traveling in Google's direction.
Well, it seems to me like we might have some other kind of duty coming into play here other than just supervision. And that would be a duty with respect to how the data is managed. Jonathan was talking about, you know, what the standard of care is in the industry. Beatmaster in the IRC wondered if there might be some way to have a legal requirement that the data in private accounts, things that are not being shared publicly and requiring moderation, et cetera, could be non-human readable, you know, except in the instance where a law enforcement subpoena has come through or some such need has arisen to access that account. But just on a day-to-day basis, as the data is flowing through Google or any other email host or chat host, if there could be some kind of legal requirement that it be anonymized. Lauren, what do you think of that concept?
You know, I think that's right. I think that, I mean, I'm not looking for a lawsuit against Google here. I think what's more important is that Google and other companies understand that, you know, you can protect your systems technologically, and you can have great privacy policies, and you can have excellent procedures in place when government comes asking, but the people within an organization are, you know, there's statistics on statistics that they are the greatest risk to privacy for information that's stored in there. And so, you know, when I talk to companies, I'm always asking them about their customer service and what kind of training that they give them about what information can be released. I remember over 10 years ago, there was a big instance where a customer service person at AOL released information that identified somebody who was in the military who was participating in a chat room as being gay, and basically outed them as a result of somebody just calling and asking some what we call, I guess, social engineering kinds of questions. And the person just hadn't been trained to understand the risks of releasing this kind of information. And so in this case, I mean, this person obviously had some very sort of specific motive, and maybe training wouldn't help have stopped this. But if you are going to put people in a position where they do have access to all of this information, I think you really need to be very careful about who you're putting there. And I think, as Denise, as you said, perhaps limiting their access in ways either technologically or otherwise, so that it's really very targeted to what they need to know in order to perform their duties, is a really smart idea. And if companies spend a little bit more time on that, I think that would be better for all of us.
How would we actually do that, though? Where would that mandate come from to make these data only machine readable or something like that? I mean, are we talking about a new law, or are we talking about some kind of regulatory action from, I don't know, the Federal Trade Commission or something? What would be the best, most efficient way to actually implement that?
Well, it could come down from on high in that way, I suppose, but also it could come up from the industry itself.
I mean, best practices are set by what the leaders in the industry are doing. And, you know, Google certainly considers itself a leader in the industry here. And so I think that when, you know, we do get into a situation where a court is looking at what the best practices are and whether a company has met them, if the leaders of the industry have implemented these sort of standards, it forces everybody else to raise the bar.
Right. But then we get into, you know, what the competing motivations are there. Obviously, Google has egg on its face right now and doesn't want to have another incident like this. But as folks in the IRC are pointing out, what we're talking about could involve a big performance hit, and Google's all about speed. So I don't know. I certainly would like to see something happen here. Jonathan, any insights on a solution to this kind of problem?
Well, you know, I think part of it comes down to the expectation of the populace or the consumer. And I'm not sure how many people expect that email or, you know, chat text they send across the internet, if it's unencrypted, is really protected or really very private. So I think that if the marketplace expected it to be absolutely private and to be accessible by the company producing the service or providing the service by only a very limited number of people or no one, perhaps requiring that it be encrypted across their network such that it's not human readable in any form. If the marketplace expected that, demanded it of their service providers, and refused to do business with a service provider that didn't provide that level of protection, then that would be the standard of the industry. But I don't think that's what the marketplace expects. I think that most people who are technologically savvy understand that if you send an unencrypted communication over the internet, it's readable by tech-savvy people, not only at that company, but anywhere.
You know, Jonathan, I hear this argument all the time. And I mean, I think in this case, it's so obvious that while I'm using the telephone, I don't expect AT&T to be listening to it. And when I'm sending email, I don't expect my ISP to be reading it. I mean, I understand the general argument about how much people care about privacy online and that that's controversial. But I think it's fair to say in this case that these kids that were conversing using Google Talk or other features did not expect that somebody who worked at Google would be able to lord this over them. And I certainly don't think their parents expected it. And I think that this isn't a case where you know, they got what they deserved by sending by using the technology. I just think that sort of blame the ignorance of the kids is not the right approach here. I don't think Google would say it is either. I mean, I think, you know, by firing these people, and I am certain that there's a lot of people at Google right now working on this problem because they're brand is that you can trust us with all your data. I mean, they work really hard to promote that idea in lots of different ways. And I think that they are really upset about this as opposed to thinking that it has to do something with people should just expect that Google employees are accessing all their information.
And I wasn't speaking to this particular case. What I was speaking to was the issue of requiring essentially all data of this sort to be only in machine-readable format and not human-readable by the service provider, by anyone at the service provider. And I think in this particular instance, I agree with you. I think the expectation of the minors involved and their parents was exactly as you stated it. I think there was a violation of trust by somebody acting outside the scope of their employment. And I think that it was appropriately handled by the company. But if you talk about it in the larger sense, is whether there should be a legal or regulatory structure that requires that level of protection, I don't know the answer to that. And we were talking about ways that that might become the standard. And we talked about it from coming on high from legislation. We talked about it coming from the industry. And my comments, and perhaps they weren't as articulate as I intended them to be, my comment was that the source of that standard can actually be from the populace, from the people themselves. We have a great deal of power in terms of how we make our consuming choices to determine what the standard is. I was not advocating for a lesser standard. I was advocating for our power to ensure that the standard that we desire, that we expect, is the standard. And the reason that you don't have the phone company listening in on your phone calls is because as a populace, we expect that not to happen. And if that was the general view of the populace and we refused to do business with companies that didn't meet our expectation, that would be the standard in this industry as well.
One thing that is tangential to this, but it's relevant, is to consider how if all these data were encrypted so that even the provider wouldn't be able to understand it, how much that would compound the expense of civil litigation in electronic discovery. Because I mean, so many times in litigated matters, you know, it requires sending a subpoena and getting information from a third party who's holding these data. Just think how. You know, electronic discovery is so expensive anyway these days. Think how that extra layer of processing to make the data meaningful for the sake of discovery would add to the cost. So this is a multifaceted problem for sure.
Yeah, and it's a hard one for consumers to police, because, you know, I guess in the olden days, you know, the Mad Men days, we had the switchboard and you could kind of hear when someone was listening in, right? There was a click. If someone's reading your email at your ISP, you have no clue, unless, you know, this is kind of an extreme situation where the parties actually knew one another. It could be happening all the time. And here I'm putting on my tinfoil hat and just no one would ever know. So, you know, I don't know how you inculcate that kind of consumer awareness and outrage and demand that you might have had at some point with the standard phone companies. Lauren, any thoughts on that?
I think it's a both has to come from the public, and certainly stories like this are the kinds of things that get people thinking about it. And then it also does have to come from the companies. I mean, I worked with a major provider who decided to encrypt all the information in the database and let it be only decrypted on the users' machines. And it was very expensive for them and a much harder engineering problem, but they decided, you know, upfront in building this new offering that it was the level of privacy that was required for the type of system that they were working on. So I would obviously not advocate for, you know, everything having to be held encrypted in every database. But I do think that, you know, you have to think about the particular type of information you're talking about and what privacy controls would be appropriate and how best to allocate those among human and machine resources. And, you know, I still think that, I still don't think it makes sense as a mandate from on top, but I think it does make sense for it to be an option that companies consider when they're thinking about how best to protect user information that they hold.
Yeah, I would love to see companies start to distinguish themselves on the way that they manage user information and to make that a real selling point. So please, folks, give us that. We'd love it. The studio, Lauren, would love it if you can tilt your camera down a little bit, if that's possible at all. From there you go. Well, not now. We're missing part of your head.
I'll tell you and everybody else a secret, which is that I'm about 9.5 months pregnant. So
congratulations.
Trying to keep the camera focused above my at my neck and above. So, but if this is better, please let me know.
Yes, I remember being at my desk and working when I was about that far along and having to reach across my huge belly to the keyboard and try and function. It's always a challenge.
It does pose interesting problems.
Yes, so we definitely appreciate even more your being here today and overcoming those challenges for us. So, well, Google was embarrassed about this. Microsoft had its own bit of embarrassment during the past week. When it came out, I think via the New York Times for the first time, that the Russian government was enforcing copyrights on Microsoft's behalf in a rather selective way and deciding to enforce them, say, on the eve of a big demonstration when a vocal environmental group was about to stage a protest and go in and seize computers on the grounds that the Windows operating system that was running there or other Microsoft software, I'm not quite sure what programs were at issue, but that they were not properly licensed. So big blow up over this. And as soon as it became very public, Microsoft immediately came very public itself and changed its policy and took steps to ensure that advocacy groups and journalists, media groups, would enjoy a blanket license. I believe, I'm not sure how broad this is, if it's just in Russia or in other countries where this might be an issue, but it, so that it could not be selectively enforced in this way, Microsoft's just going to come in and say, hey, you know what, no need to worry about licensing, we've got your back there. So this it has been a pretty interesting development. I'm worried and wondering who they're going to classify as a dissident or an advocate group or a journalist, because those things can get a little bit blurry and difficult to classify, and possibly someone might have some things that they want to engage in and get targeted by the government and not enjoy this nice new policy from Microsoft. Jonathan, do you have any thoughts about copyright being used as a pretext in this way?
Well, clearly there's a problem with using the copyright as a pretext to limit political speech. And I think that the fact that it's happening in Russia is not probably surprising to any of us. But we certainly, I think, intrinsically feel pain that that's being done. I think Microsoft reacted appropriately by granting the blanket license to a category of people or groups of people that fit into certain categories in terms of their political relationship to the existing Russian government. And they have limited, at least at this point, the new licensing scheme to just Russia. But I would expect that we would see a similar situation in China if that became an issue later on. I do find it interesting to note that the change in policy came just 2 days after the New York Times piece that raised this issue, because it clearly, I think, came out of a concern that Microsoft had that this would be detrimental to their sales here in this country, because obviously people would have sort of a visceral reaction to the government's use of copyright law in this way. But I think that they reacted appropriately to it. I think that the interesting question may be is if it could be used that way in this country in terms of terror investigations. We talk a lot about the Patriot Act and how our right to privacy and some other rights have been altered since 9/11. It's interesting to look at ways that this could actually be used in this country in a similar sort of fashion and determine how we would address the issue here.
Evan, we've gone back and forth about ACTA before on the show, and when I heard about this, I thought immediately that, well, you know, here we are putting an international copyright infrastructure into place that is a whole new layer of copyright enforcement laws, and Michael Geist apparently had that thought too, because he posted on it as well up in Canada. And I'm just wondering, you know, if this gives you any more trepidation about ACTA finally coming into being.
I think it could very much so, because one of the real problems here, one of the things that makes this troublesome is the fact that so much apparently was going on in terms of enforcement in Russia that wasn't being directly controlled by Microsoft. It was the Russian government doing this on behalf of Microsoft as the copyright owner. Now, I know that there are some there's some indication that counsel for Microsoft was perhaps being overly aggressive and perhaps too solicitous to the authorities in Russia. But that's, you know, setting those things aside, there's a real danger when the enforcement is going on behalf of someone else in a remote part of the world, away from the headquarters or the real central command of the copyright owner. And that's problematic anytime you're going to do anything on an international scale. Going back just a little bit, one of the things that I find really troublesome about what Microsoft has done here on this by giving this blanket license, I see this as really opening up a can of worms, dealing with some great generalities and vagueness that's going to be very difficult to resolve. Because in the reports that we have about this, the nature of this license are very loosely described. And you could actually read it to be a blanket license to all NGOs, all non-governmental organizations. And that the interests of those NGOs really could cover a broad spectrum. So Microsoft is putting itself in an interesting position by offering this blanket license at the risk of giving such a blanket license to organizations who may have interests that are antithetical to a real strict property right type of intellectual property ownership that Microsoft, through the BSA and the SIIA and others, seems to espouse and actually put into action here. So that makes me a bit skeptical as to their motives. And, you know, it's still kind of putting this in the framework of ACTA that you're talking about. This is just so much more complicated and so much more nuanced on an international scale. But it makes me very, somewhat skeptical of their motives on this, seeing it more as damage control, dealing with public relations fallout than actually dealing with a particular problem here, just wanting to at least give the appearance that they're doing the right thing until people hopefully forget about this. And by that time, the purported temporary nature of this blanket license will expire. I think they say it'll extend until 2012. I bet you there are a lot of people in Redmond keeping their fingers crossed that people will just kind of forget about this and they don't have to keep this blanket license going on forever and ever.
Right. And the steps they've taken now certainly can't address the problem that Jonathan raised, that it could be used selectively by governments that, you know, the world has more trust in, such as the very government we are all under here in the United States.
Yes, and that selectivity could actually give rise to further and more difficult criticisms.
Right, exactly. Lauren, solution to this issue of copyright being used as a hammer to protect interests other than copyright?
I feel like when I first read the story in the New York Times, I thought I was reading something in The Onion. I mean, it's so incredible to read about how, you know, I mean, it shouldn't feel incredible anymore because we see it so often, but seeing a U.S. company, you know, in ways that are the Times seem to have reported explicitly, were, you know, pushing piracy at the expense of, you know, human rights work. And so I guess, I mean, this, the license is a, you know, I think it's, it has, you know, it could be seen as a good thing, could be seen as a bad thing. I certainly think if you're Microsoft and you're looking at this problem, there's not a lot of good options because they don't want to relinquish their, piracy efforts. But they do have a PR problem, and hopefully they do also recognize they have an actual problem, which is that dissident groups are being targeted. Rebecca McKinnon had a piece on her blog, and you know, one of the points that she made was that this is a problem that Microsoft has known about for a while, and groups have talked to Microsoft about, and they didn't just find out about it this weekend. So I certainly think, as somebody in your chat room said, this was the license was something well thought out. It wasn't something they just came up with this in response to the New York Times story. And I think, you know, this is one of the issues where the U.S. actually has a real problem in terms of our internet freedoms and human rights, which is there's a lot of great things to say about the free speech that we have here. There's a lot of great things to say about, some of the levels of access that we have and things that... there's not censorship problems the way there are in the rest of the world. But IP rights and piracy continue to be our Achilles heel in terms of trying to spread freedom to other places, which is there's on the one hand, even when you read speeches like Secretary Clinton's, we're promoting the use of the internet for freedom, for dissident action, as a tool for change. And at the same time, you know, but in the next sentence in the speech, we also want to protect, you know, U.S. intellectual property interests. And I, as much as anybody else, agree those are both important goals. It's just, I'm not sure that, they're equivalent goals when we're talking about some of the types of organizations that were described in the New York Times piece. So my general sort of feeling on this is that, you know, again, we have a story like what we were discussing in Google where, you know, some good reporting brings to light something that is happening consistently. and makes us think about it. But we need some sort of real strategic way of thinking about how to deal with balancing these interests, rather than just sort of, you know, putting this license out there, you know, and see what happens next.
Well, I want to shift gears for a minute here. I think we've been talking about important sort of privacy and policy considerations. And there was a case that came out last Friday as we were recording the show that we've all been, I'm sure, thinking about this week. It sort of takes things to a different level. It talks about whether or not you can sell pieces of software and whether a license gives you the right to do that. We're all used to the EULAs that come with the software that you buy off the shelf. And of course, when you download software, you're governed by that kind of thing too. This involved Autodesk software that was actually on disks and could be packaged up and resold again. A gentleman named Werner bought some of this software from a company that had upgraded its Autodesk licenses. So it had version 14 of the software. It upgraded to version 15. It was restricted from selling version 14. And it, you know, like many software deals involve, it could buy the next upgraded version for a cost reduced from what it would have cost if they'd bought it fresh off the shelf. So rather than destroying their old copies of Autodesk, they resold them to this gentleman named Werner, who then attempted to resell them on eBay. And he wound up in a lawsuit over that. He brought the lawsuit because he'd had his eBay sales canceled for DMCA reasons when Autodesk complained. So he finally got a definitive decision. He's already been through a trial court decision and up to now the Ninth Circuit, where it was determined that no, indeed, Mr. Werner could not sell his software because those sorts of rights did not actually transfer with the license. That the language in the license restricting sales, forbidding resales of software was enforceable. And it's kind of hard to think why people should care too much about that in this particular instance if you look just narrowly at the case. Well, so the guy couldn't resell his software on eBay. So what? But the ramifications of this are actually broader. And Evan, can you explain to our viewers and listeners why I think that's the case?
Well, I'll try to explain to them why I think you think that's the case. I'm not sure it's that big of a deal.
okay.
I mean, and well, let me just touch on that point. Why I don't think it's such a big of a deal. It's important. It's notable. It's worth talking about because it is important in that it relates to the first sale doctrine, and it's the Ninth Circuit. Obviously, a lot of important stuff happens within the Ninth Circuit when it comes to software and technology. But here we are. It's 2010. We are, everybody knows about cloud computing. Not only do we have software as a service, but we've got, you know, platform as a service and infrastructure as a service and all that stuff. So what that means is that it's less and less important all the time that software or any copyrighted work, for that matter, books, for example, music, be distributed on a tangible medium, like a CD or printed paper or cassette tape. this case essentially says, well, it does say that it's not a sale of that copyrighted work, of the stuff that's on that tangible medium thing. If the copyright owner says that you merely have a license and puts some restrictions on your ability to transfer that, or puts restrictions on how you can use that. Now, it's that the second of those points, the restrictions on how you can transfer that, that don't seem to really have a whole lot of teeth these days when an increasing amount of the software that we use, we never see or experience or have in a tangible format. So I don't know why it would matter what my restrictions are on the ability for me to transfer to someone else a copy of the software that I have, because it would be really an odd thing to do to try to go into the server and pull down code so that I could give that to someone else. That we just don't think in those terms in anymore. But here's why I will venture a guess as to why I think we could formulate a big deal about it. And that is because this could transfer to other types of media other than software. The holding clearly does not have to be read to pertain only to software, but it could pertain to other types of works like books. I guess conceivably books could now come with a shrink wrap license, like where you peel it off and say, by opening, this package, you're agreeing to this license. It could have these restrictions on there that would make it an infringement to sell your copy of the book. That seems like it's going awfully far, but I'm not sure that would be inconsistent. That a cause of action for or claim for infringement in that situation would be inconsistent with the Werner holding here. I also think that it could be a big deal because of what you wrote about on your ZDNet blog, Denise, by saying how the court could have gotten to the final conclusion that it got to here if it had taken a different route that maybe didn't upset everybody so much. Because on these facts, and maybe I should put it back on you to explain this, but at least I can kind of tee it up for you here. You wrote very well that the facts in Werner are a situation where Werner, who was the guy trying to sell this stuff on eBay, didn't buy the software directly from Autodesk. He bought it from a company called CTA, which had been a licensee of Autodesk. And what CTA did was they promised to Autodesk when they upgraded to version 15, that they would get rid of the version 14 disks. So, and I think this is a term that you came up with, bringing it over from economics, by violating that promise to Autodesk that they would get rid of their version 14 disks, they deepened the discount that they had on that upgrade, because they benefited by selling the copies of these disks that they wished, or that Autodesk wanted them to get rid of, and that factored into the pricing of all this stuff. So CTA got an unfair, let's just say a bigger discount than what Autodesk bargained for. So I think an important point here, and this is probably the thing that's the most worth discussing, is the court could have somehow read into this that you don't own something that you have promised to get rid of it. What is it you said in the article? If it's old, it can't be sold.
Yeah.
Love that. That sums it up right there. What really could have been a more wise way of coming about this that wouldn't have gotten everybody so up in arms over all of this stuff.
Yeah. People have been pushing back on me saying, well, there's no property right that's transferred that's relinquished just because they failed to comply with their contractual agreement to destroy the software. Maybe there would be a breach of contract claim over
that.
Why not?
What's the basis of that pushback? You have in real property, for example, you can have a deed conveying Blackacre from mm-hmm. O to A, and there's conditions subsequent that you remember back in law school in real property. If O conveys Blackacre to A, so long as alcohol is not consumed on the premises, then it'll revert back to O. I don't see the problem in that those rights being relinquished if there's some kind of violation of a condition subsequent. But
right, no, I'm not saying I agreed with it. I'm still standing by that the court missed an opportunity to decide this case without jeopardizing the first sale doctrine in the way that it did. And that's really what's disturbing to me about the case is that we're sort of in this strange place where software and other creative works are still distributed in physical means. But as you pointed out, Evan, we're moving to an age where that's no longer going to be the case. Discs and CDs and dongles to secure software that's sold that way.
You said dongle.
Dongle. I said dongle. they're moving into the archaic past. And as they do, under this case, I think so is the first sale doctrine, because how are you going to ever have an instance where an ownership right is going to pass if the way that you're distributing works is purely electronically. Jonathan, what do you think?
Well, I think the decision doesn't really signify a change in the law, a significant change in the law. The Northern District of California in an Adobe case back in 2000 came to the same conclusion, said that essentially we don't ever purchase software anymore, that we merely license it, and that we don't, the ownership's not transferred. And that was a 10-year-old decision that was followed 2 years later by a decision of the same court, following this, you know, coming to the same conclusion. So I don't view this decision in terms of the legal concept involved as being particularly new, particularly in light of the fact that when the first sale doctrine was first articulated by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1908 and then later codified in 1909, it included essentially an exception to the first sale doctrine for copyrighted works which were leased or rented. And obviously a license would come in under that as well because there's not a transfer of ownership. Now, I don't believe that the decision is creates a change in the law, and I don't feel like it's going to affect other medium, because remember, the law treats software very differently, because the ability to copy software cheaply, easily, and in mass quantities is different than in any other medium. And you can make those copies without any, you know, significant degradation in quality. If I, for books, for instance, it will never happen with books because we have public libraries, and the consumer base will not accept a shrink wrap license that doesn't allow them to transfer their books. And you can't shrink, you can't effectively take a book, have a license agreement that says only you can read this book, and then you have to burn it. No one's going to accept that. And you know, if somebody tried to impose that that obligation, people would just wait and get it from the library when it's, you know, transferred legally. You know, they essentially just borrow it. But the fact is that if you copy a book, if I take my copy of Canterbury Tales and I decide that Evan wants a copy of it, but I want to keep my original copy, if I Xerox it and bound it with twine and give it to him, it's not the same thing. But software is the same thing when you copy it. So that's why software is treated differently. And I think I read somewhere that there's a fear not only that this will kill ownership of books, which I don't think it will, but that it will kill ownership of music. The fact is that ownership of music is already dead. If you read the license agreement, which I took a look at today for iTunes, which is how most people get their music nowadays, you have significant restrictions on your ability to transfer those songs that you get. You can only use those songs on 5 Apple-authorized devices at any one time, for instance. And you can only burn an audio playlist up to 7 times. So if I have songs on my iPod or on my iTunes, and I want to burn 7 CDs of songs in different playlists, I can only do 7. I can't do 8. So the fact is that the ownership of music is already dead long before this decision. The ownership of books will never be affected, but this concept, as it applies to software, has been in play for at least a decade.
Well, Lauren, Jonathan's gone all Scott McNeely on us here about music, just like privacy, music ownership is dead. What do you think?
Oh, well, I think exactly the same thing is going to happen to books if we're not careful. I love the idea of the library as being immune to these market forces, but libraries are going online. Libraries are finding it much cheaper to buy books and put them online. We have Google Books, which is, you know, taking over the copying. And I do a lot of work with the Internet Archive, which finds navigating all of these laws extremely difficult. And without first sale for the digital era, I think we really have a problem for libraries. So I guess, you know, this is a move that has been happening, you know, as Jonathan says, for a really long time. We no longer own the stuff we buy. We have licensed it to be used in very specific ways as the owner has permitted. And we sort of see it's happening every day with the stuff that we actually use. And in the law, we see periodically it being reinforced with decisions like this. So, you know, to my mind, I guess I look at this and I'm particularly concerned about where we are going with books, which is something near and dear to my heart. And I'm concerned, you know, about how first sale of digital information remains viable. And, you know, I've looked at this quite a bit, and in the absence of some sort of legislative solution, which might, you know, actually happen if, as Jonathan said, people really just will not allow the library of the 21st century to fail, either a legislative solution or a court decision going in a completely different direction than the one we see here. But I really am scared about the future of libraries, and I do see, you know, one more chip in that architecture being created by this decision.
All right. Well, I am frightened about it too, and I don't know how we're going to have this play out in the digital arena, because I think, you know, if looking back retrospectively, I think creators might say, you know, this is the digital distribution is the best thing that's ever happened to them, because they can clamp down on this aftermarket in their works, and they can make sure that every time something is transferred, they manage to get a piece of that transfer. So I do think it's going to be up to the courts to, and possibly the other lawmakers, our legislators, to ensure that that's not the world that we wind up living in as things become more and more digital. But this case doesn't give me a whole lot of confidence that that's what's going to happen. So I do have our tip of the week for us. And that is, if you are thinking of putting the word droid in your software product or service, be really, really cautious about that. Apparently, Google has some complicated licensing that it has worked out about calling its phone, and I guess the phone makers might have to be blanketed under this too, the droid phone, because apparently George Lucas owns the droids. They have trademarked that term, and there is a small company called Adroid. You can find them online, and they are at Adroid on Twitter, that are the most recent recipient of C&D from the big Death Star lawyers at Google, asking them not to use the term droid as part of their name, because that thing is trademarked elsewhere. Evan, do you think that this is okay for someone to be able to lock up a term like droid, especially when Android is something that had nothing at all to do with Star Wars?
Well, in principle, I don't think that's good. I mean, all we have in this situation here is a copy of the cease and desist letter, and we know a little bit about it. The guy's calling it Adroid, and, you know, Lucasfilm's rights, I guess, are, you know, to the word droid. If I'm not mistaken, an android is a generic term, right? I mean, that wasn't a coined term. That's proprietary to anybody, kind of as a general member of the lexicon. So, you know, I get a little tired of seeing these things come out over use of the word droid or variations or marks that are comprised at least in part of that. And I wouldn't be too upset to see somebody actually try to take Lucasfilms to the mat on this. This would be a perfect example where a declaratory judgment action would be a lot of fun to watch. Not saying that I would necessarily want to be involved, you know, in myself as a plaintiff in that kind of action. The declaratory judgment action, you know, being where you go to the judge and say, "Judge, tell Lucasfilms to leave me alone. I'm not doing anything right or doing anything wrong on this." You know, to be honest, when I first saw the word Adroid, I started thinking about adenoids. So I wasn't confused at all, thinking that it was Android. I even a moron in a hurry.
Unfortunately named product on a number of levels.
Yes, it just really gave me a sore throat when I saw this. I don't know.
I'm going to hit up the Adroid people and see if maybe they can come on the show so we can get a follow-up on this and see how they fare with the big Lucasfilm enterprise, or I guess I'm mixing my sci-fi shows there. I'd like to give us our resource of the week, which there is a new book called A Republic of Letters. It's called Common as Air. The review that I read in the New York Times is called A Republic of Letters. Common as Air by Lewis Hyde looks like a really nice overview of the development of copyright law. I haven't read it yet. Have any of you on the panel here read this book yet? It looks quite interesting, and I just wanted to highlight it for folks that are interested in the stuff we talk about.
Yeah, I haven't read it, but it does look good.
He apparently is also the author of The Gift, A Defense of the Non-Commercial Aspects of Art, which is, it was an excellent point someone in our chat room made about the last story we were talking about, digital rights and first sale, that, you know, there's this push going on toward the digitization of everything that is created. And while that's all well and good and convenient, it does make it difficult for there to be any permanence of works, and also makes it difficult for there to be the ability to track changes over time in something. It's an interesting time we live in here, folks. And I think that this book, Common as Air, will give a lot of history and context to that. And I wanted, before we wrapped up, to give some history and context to Lauren's appearance on our show. If folks aren't familiar with Lauren, she is really a luminary in the field of cyber law and privacy, and we're really fortunate to have had her. She was the public policy director for EFF. She has been with Stanford Center for Internet and Society, and done all sorts of interesting things, such as work with Keith Teer, an old acquaintance of mine back at Real Names back in the day. So I've been really, really thrilled to have the chance to catch up with you, Lauren. And why don't you tell us about Blurry Edge, what you're doing these days?
Oh, well, thank you for those lovely words, Denise. It was actually quite a delight to get invited to join you on the show and get to talk with you. Blurry Edge Strategies is just a consulting practice that I started about, I guess, at the beginning of this year to take some of the work that I've been doing in public policy and privacy from the academic and advocacy environments and try to bring it to companies directly. So to work with them on some of the things that we discussed today, how to build better databases so that they protect privacy, create better policies and procedures internally. And I really find that there's a lot of companies out there that, want to do the right thing and aren't quite sure how. And so most of what I've been doing is working with them. I've also been, working with the Internet Archive, trying to continue to help to save the library, which I'm passionate about. A number of other different. I've been working with on a report on internet freedom that looks at how it compares across different countries, and in particular, what's going on with the United States. So I really appreciate the opportunity to come on the show today and talk about all these issues that I remain passionate about, and I know you have been talking about and writing about for such a long time. So thank you.
Our pleasure. And we hope you'll come back and join us again sometime after the new baby joins you. So congratulations and good luck with all that.
Thank you.
So it's, folks can find Lauren after we wrap up today at blurryedge.com, her new business. And she's also Lauren Gelman on Twitter. So go follow her and keep an eye on what she's doing, of course, in a non-creepy, non-stalkery, non-privacy violating sort of way. Good luck with everything, Lauren.
Thank you.
And also, Jonathan, it's been a huge pleasure to meet you. Thank you for all your thoughts and insights today. You want to tell us a little bit more about your practice?
I'm just a country lawyer, Denise. I am a commercial litigator doing intellectual property work. Most of my clients are internet companies, so that's the space I work in typically. I work out of an office in Northern Virginia, which is one of the D.C. Suburbs. And I have the distinction of my career is that Evan Brown and I handled a case together once in the district for of Northern District of Illinois in the Chicago area. So that's the highlight of my legal career.
Right.
Oh, and as it would
neither
be.
One of us... Go ahead.
I hope that's prominent on your resume somewhere.
I'm moving it right to the top, Denise.
Good.
I was getting ready to say the best thing about that is neither one of us got thrown in jail. So that's that was positive.
That's
not
a win.
In that case.
So please go check out Jonathan's blog, folks. Where can they find that?
It's www.ecommercelaw.typepad.com.
And
if
he
you just
is
Google e-commerce law.
Wonderful. And he is Jonathan.Frieden, F-R-I-E-D-E-N, on Twitter. So really a great pleasure to have you on the show, and hope to have you back sometime soon.
Thank you, Denise. It was a pleasure to be here.
And Evan, I know we're going to have you back sometime soon, and that is really one of the things that keeps me going in life. So thank you so much for coming back on the show. Folks can find Evan at internetcases.com. And of course, he's Internet Cases on Twitter as well. And we definitely want you to take care of your adenoids and go have some green beer. Maybe that will be the cure.
That sounds like a good plan. Good.
Yes. All right, folks. With that, we will wrap up This Week in Law, episode 78. Little programming note for next week. We're going to do a book-oriented show where I'm sure we'll talk more about the first sale doctrine. We're going to have Chris Dawson, who's the education blogger over at ZDNet and pays a lot of attention to what's happening in the world of ebooks and textbooks as they affect the academic arena. And also we are going to have a literary agent who was recommended to me by Charles Pettit, who is a great literary lawyer, and this agent is one of his clients. So I'm looking forward to that too. And that will take place on Friday the 24th, 11 Pacific time. That's when we record live every week on Fridays. So tune in at live.twit.tv to catch us there. And also check out our Facebook page before the show. I always try and post some stories that we'd love to get your feedback on. That's at facebook.com/thisweekinlaw. And folks can always send me an email too. I'm denise@twit.tv, or hit me up on Twitter. I'm D Howell there. So this has been a really fun show, and we'll see you next week. Take care.